This is Screen Divers. On this week's episode, we talk about Trapped in Paradise, aka Caged in Paradise. How are you, Ricky?
Hey, how are you doing?
How are you, Steve?
I'm good. How are you?
Hey. I'm all right. So this movie was directed by George Gallo, written by George Gallo, produced by George Gallo, and distributed by 20th Century Fox. It came out in 1994. It has a running time of 111 minutes, and it stars a golden cast. It really does. Nicolas Cage, John Lovitz, Dana Carvey, John Ashton, Donald Moffat, Richard Jenkins, and the list goes on and on and on. Machan Amick, which I completely forgot about. And then she popped up years later with Riverdale, which I didn't watch because I don't want to mar my memory of Archie comics. So I've never went there. I'm sure that Ricky's already put in a face. He probably watched Riverdale.
No.
I'm sure he did. CW.
Yeah, you don't belittle Machan Amick's career. You know where I'm gonna go. We're gonna talk about the good stuff.
Okay, we're gonna talk about
the better stuff after this film.
I'm sure. So I had a funny memory of this movie, and yet again I think it was fabricated because I don't think I watched this. I thought I did.
Oh, mate. Oh, that God. Actually makes it funnier. That makes it Jesus funnier that Christ. You got to pick. So, to all listeners out there, this is our Christmas month. Woo!
Yes, it is.
This was meant to be our Christmas comedy that was picked by Umber. Woo!
You know what? There was a desperate for our listeners and Steve that doesn't know this. I called Ricky an hour and a half ago, and I went, "Hey, man, any chance that we can do the ref instead?" And he goes, "No, no, we can't do this now."
That was filmed in the same location, wasn't it?
I don't know, but it's a better movie.
It's Ontario.
It's a better movie than this. Holy shit! However. I did say Caged in Paradise. Man, there is so much cage in this.
Oh,
there's
my God.
A lot of cage. Like
full going, stream cage.
Yeah, and it's good. It's good.
It's good.
Look, man, this movie is beloved by a lot of people, and apparently it's finding its audience now in 2024. we're going like full Idiocracy, and this movie is becoming like a fucking cult classic at the moment.
I might spend this episode just reading at random times, just reading titles from the IMDb reviews. For example, this one, way underrated.
Hey, there's some important shit happening in this. I don't know if you guys have noticed that during the exchange between Lovitz and Cage, one of the times, right after John Lovitz's phone call, he passes him like a copy of a tabloid, which is the Weekly World News. Yeah. And on the first page, we see another appearance of the Fantomatic Bat Boy.
Yeah.
And the headline reads, "Bat Child Found in Cave." You know what I'm talking about? You know Bat Boy?
Mm-hmm.
It's the Weekly World News.
Wasn't Nicolas Cage actually a huge fan anyway of Weekly World, which is probably why it appeared.
So, Ricky, hello. What's this movie about?
This is about a family dynamic between three brothers who all have some element of criminality within their lives. Two of them are leaving prison and sell to the third brother, who wasn't in prison for some reason. I don't believe they go into why he wasn't in prison. I assume they did a heist or something together, and two of them got caught, and he like ran away and tried to better himself. But anyway, that we'll talk about that later. And he gets offered a trip out of New York, which he takes because the police are chasing after them again. And when they get there, there is an easy bank to rob, which they take that opportunity. But hilarity ensues when they get trapped in Paradise, Pennsylvania.
Ontario, actually. Oh, yeah. That's what this movie was.
Sorry, Ontario. Yeah.
In paradise.
And look, a little factoid, it was actually snowing in Ontario as well, because the movie, the shoot took place between, I think, January and April or some shit. But they still, there wasn't enough snow. Because I had to justify, because it would bring plausibility to the story, Mr. Gallo, they used 75,000 tons of potato flakes to add snow to the existing snow in this. Man, this movie features the most ineffectual FBI and police force I have ever seen in a fucking movie. The car chases are a fucking disaster, to the point in which, first of all the cast features in this are pieces of shit. Yep. All of them. Starting, and of course, thank you, IMCDB, whatever the fuck, the database is called. I have the name of the fucking car that our restaurant manager, which is Nicolas Cage, is driving. It's a 1972 Chevrolet Impala that I cannot believe that actually works, that the car runs. In fact, there's the beat when John Lovitz comes out of prison and they're walking towards the car. And John Lovitz goes, "Hey, Alvin, I heard the economy was in the shithouse. I had no idea. Look at that abandoned car." Yeah. And Nicolas Cage goes, "That's my car." Fucking, it's a piece of shit. It's a pile of shit. All of the cars in this look beat up. It's a disaster. Oh, man. I got nothing else on this, really, like at the moment, at least.
From the Variety review back in 94.
Oh, my God.
This actually said, is undoubtedly the first movie in which a horse-drawn sleigh is chased by a cop car on Christmas Eve.
Fucking hell. They tried to live this down so many times.
In apparently many different ways.
Yeah, and four lefts is a circle. Holy shit. You know, about Dana Carvey, I love Dana because, you know, I'm a big Wayne's World fan and I love his work on SNL. Yeah. But in this, dude, apparently the entire Looney Tunes fucking laughter that destroys this movie, to be honest. Every fucking time he does that, my skin crawled. But his face, because I had to watch a bunch of stuff on YouTube before this, he's trying to play a young Mickey Rourke. And I gotta say, he succeeds. He succeeds. However, his voice is way too high-pitched all the way through it. And he also reminded me of Pantoliano's Ralphie from from The Sopranos. Mm-hmm. So if you put like a young Mickey Rourke and Ralphie from The Sopranos, you get this character.
So the big thing about that was he was also channeling a executive producer called Brad Grey. And supposedly from the dailies, 20th Century Fox got so annoyed, or Brad Grey got so annoyed with this impression, that they send somebody down to the set to cease and desist him.
And from LA, they send executives to go, stop it.
To say, stop doing Brad Grey. Just leave him alone. Leave this producer alone. And he's actually an amazing producer because before this, he was doing a lot of stuff like the Gary Shandling Show. And then afterwards, he did things like Replacement Killers. He was executive producer on Scary Movie. Mm. Just Shoot Me, the TV series. So Running with Scissors, that's a great film. And also, he was one of the producers on The Departed. So he isn't like a high up producer. And so 20th Century Fox.
I'm pretty sure that he probably sent a bunch of people to go, stop this.
And Nicolas Cage's response to that was, no, Dana, keep doing it. Go. Just keep going. Go. Keep doing it.
Man.
I'm Cage.
I got to say, though, the opening sequence, you know, the entire wallet being kicked down the subway station. There is a moment in which the camera is fixed on the tiled wall and you can see Cage walking in and out of frame because he has this quandary. He has the moral quandary of what's, you know, if he's going to keep the money or not. And that was funny. The opening of this movie is really funny. Like, even the entire confessional sequence is hilarious. But how the fuck? Like, he goes to see the priest. The priest tells him, it's like, last time you were here, this is New York City. How the fuck? How influential of a character is he that people remember? I can assume that your priest will remember who you are. And also, what's the word? Because the priest is doing crosswords. What is that?
I knew you were going to ask something.
Oh,
like
my God.
Was it like existential? No, it wasn't existential.
It's like redemption or something like that. My God.
I don't know. But it's just the way he actually storms out of the confessional and starts knocking on the door. Everyone turns around. There's a lot of airplane Naked Gun moments in this, in which you get like a large group of people just turning around and looking at the protagonist.
Yeah.
It happens in the cafe when they, I mean, just the juxtaposition of them holding a bank later on and then having to go to the cafe and moving everyone from the cafe into the bank. Oh, my God. I thought that was funny, man.
It was funny, but it's obviously, you know, you're walking down the street with a gun, basically, or across the street with a gun, I should say.
When the
wearing ski masks and those crazy sunglasses.
There is so much Cage going unchecked that it's great. Now, I'm actually going to incorporate some of this one-liners into my own life now. Whenever I don't find the keys, or we come home, or Anna's opening the door, and I'm impatiently waiting, I'm just going to go, key! Out of control. Completely out of control.
Put your hands up if you got the key. Oh, no, put your hands down.
It's a disaster. Yeah. Oh. But there's a bit as well with John Lovitz, kind of, because they bounce off each other really well. And I think John Lovitz and Nicolas Cage ended up in being friends after this.
Yeah.
I think I watched the same interview that you watched on the Kevin Pollak show, Ricky.
Oh, with John Lovitz?
Yeah. John Lovitz and Kevin Pollak. And they're talking about this. And I mean, myself and Ricky were talking about this right before recording. Is the embodiment of an unreliable narrator, you know, but it's just that these anecdotes are so entertaining. You could choose to believe them or not. But he was telling the story about him and Nicolas Cage on their way to a party or something, and Cage coming to John Lovitz's house. And at one point, he had to get changed. So he leaves the room, goes to put on a T-shirt, comes back into the room. And the T-shirt was a wrap-up T-shirt from Trapped in Paradise. And Cage goes, no, please.
That's the same interview where he's basically talking about Kevin Pollak's song.
Oh, yeah. I choose to believe each and every one of those anecdotes, including the fact that he accused, Ricky, you know about this, right? The Gallo thing, what John Lovitz had to say about the director.
Pretty much that Gallo was not, he just didn't want to direct. This is everything from John Lovitz's interview, where it basically put across that like Cage was pretty much doing a lot of the blocking and the actual work on set over Gallo, and Gallo was refusing to even take part in any of it, even though you know he wrote it, he produced it, it was his baby. I mean,
George Gallo as well is synonymous for films which are great, like Midnight Run.
Yeah,
I mean these are fast, quick paced. Action movies, technically.
There are similarities between these two movies, man. Fucking John Ashton, which is in this, he's also in that.
Yeah.
Like, for people that don't remember what John Ashton is, we lost him, I think, last year. He was Target in Beverly Hills Cop. Yeah. So, but there's a lot of character actors in this, and I'm a huge Richard Jenkins fan. He's always funny. I think it looks like his scenes were cut here. Because I wish they let him run a little bit more with the disgruntled FBI agent role in this.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, at the end of the day, you need to remember, though, this is a Christmas movie because it gets pretty schmaltzy, dude. It really does.
Like, I was talking to Sally about this, which was that it doesn't quite hit even the Hallmark Christmas movie notes. And the Hallmark Christmas movie notes, they are schmaltzy, they are ridiculous, they are like, you can see like four or five of them that got released this year on Netflix alone, and they all have that same like, we're not even going to be offensive in any way whatsoever.
This movie fucking gets offensive.
Yeah, like this. There's even, and I'm sidelining here, there's even a Christmas movie out this year, which is basically The Full Monty, but an American version of The Full Monty, where they're trying to save a bar by stripping.
God, no.
And it's not even a, there's not, it doesn't.
You know what it's, it, what's it called?
Oh, what? Miss,
doesn't matter. It doesn't
Merry,
matter.
Merry Gentleman or something. Anyway, okay. And it's got Chad Michael Murray in it. Anyway, and yes, I've
you
already
know
seen
a hell
it.
Of a lot about you know this movie.
What? I have already seen it. Don't even go down there. I will admit
any Magic Mike kind of theme movie.
Yeah.
you'll watch, right?
Yeah, of course. That's, I guess, of course, yeah, you know, okay. Because okay, we must appreciate the male form as well as the female form, because that's the right thing to do, Umbar.
Of course, of course. I'm not interested in playing this game of gay chicken that you're playing.
But anyway, my point is that like those scenes, like I watched this film a few too many times because I kept falling asleep during it.
But what the fuck? How?
The first time I watched it, I got to the scene where they were putting the mum into the trunk and passed out. I just passed out. And then the following day, I tried to rewatch it again from the point where they were putting the mum in the trunk, and I passed out when Dana Carvey was in the middle of the river being saved, and I passed out again. And then the following day, I tried to watch it again. This time I started again from them in the canoe on the boat.
Okay.
And I got to them in the diner, and I passed out again.
Dude,
so
this isn't 2001. I remember I had that scene. Like my last viewing in 2001, I was riveted because I needed an adult brain to enjoy it. But I remember when I was younger, it's the only movie that is up there for me that it took me four goes to watch.
Did you keep falling asleep?
2001. No, falling asleep, but I just didn't hold my attention when I was younger. And then recently I watched it and I'm like, oh my God, I must have been a fucking idiot because it's a masterpiece. But what?
But you see,
I'm not drawing parallels between Trapped in Paradise and 2001. Eh? Okay, I just dropped it in the conversation. Oh, I want people to know.
Oh, mate, you know what? I had a moment there where I thought you were talking about last time I watched this film in 2001. I didn't realize you were talking about 2001.
No.
The masterpiece 2001.
No, this is Trapped in Paradise: A Christmas Odyssey. That's what this is.
No, it's even worse. It's like did it come later or come before Groundhog Day? Did it come later or it came later.
Yeah.
And also there was another film, Palookaville, that came later after this film in 95. And
is it the one with Jeremy Garofalo? Palookaville.
I want to say yes, but it's definitely the one with Vincent Gallo, which is why I remember. Because of Vincent Gallo.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But Palookaville was a similar thing. Small town, three
brothers. Can you see Steve looking at his 10,000 tabs open?
I'm trying to find Palookaville.
Palookaville.
Anyway, it was three brothers. They're going nowhere in life. They even try and start a cab service for the elderly of the town, and it goes horribly wrong. And then they decide to do a heist on a money van, and it goes horribly wrong, just like this film. But I don't think they even get the money out of the truck. Like, there's just a comedy of errors, and someone gets shot, and then they go on the run again. But my point is that several films after this film took the same concept and did it better. I'm just going to say better. Yeah.
Well, actually, my reference to the Garofalo movie, nothing to do with Palookaville, which I have seen, because now I'm looking myself on IMDb.
Yeah.
The movie that I thought you were talking about was Clay Pigeons.
Oh, right.
Okay. I think. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, about 1994, let's talk about that a year. Because I just kept, like, first of all, it blew my mind. And the moment I found this out, I'm going to fight for us to cover this. At the risk of spoiling my memory of it. First of all, what I'm about to mention is Dennis Hopper in it and Cage together. And the movie in question is Red Rock West, which I really, it's film noir kind of thing. It was that period of the late 90s or the second half of the 90s when you had movies that are super underrated, in my opinion, like U-Turn by Oliver Stone. I adore that movie for all the wrong reasons, okay? And I'm sure that maybe a revisit is not ideal. And maybe Red Rock Quest falls under that category. But in 1994, you had Kate starring in Red Rock, or at least released that year, Red Rock West, Guardian Tess, It Could Happen to You, and Trapped in Paradise. Now, those three movies were successes, apparently, when it comes down to box office. This movie made $8 million. And guess what? I was having trouble finding the budget for this online.
They haven't released the budget online.
I think it's unreleased, yeah. Because I think they lost a bunch of money, a lot of money making this. However, it found its audience later. And then look, going back to 1994 and what happened in the 90s, after this, nothing, like this didn't damage Cage's career at all, man. In 95, he ended up in doing Kiss of Death and Leaving Las Vegas.
Yeah.
In 96, The Rock. In 97, Face Off and Con Air. In 98, Snake Eyes. To your movie that you guys fucking like, you fucking psychopaths. City of Angels, which was not a movie for us, but it was a critical success. Then in 99, 8 Mile, Bringing Out the Dead. In 2000, so you think that this would have, if anything, 94 was a very important year for Cage's career because it kind of started launching him into stardom. You know what I mean? Like in this, there's a lot of unchecked Cage. In this case, I think this movie, as if you look online, dude, and you look for crazy reels about Cage going crazy, the majority of the clips you see are from this movie, dude. There's a lot of stuff. Like, there's a lot of one-liners. I'm tempted by actually closing this episode with the real Cage going crazy in this. I think that would be funny. I will.
Yeah,
for sure, for sure. Who did you watch this with, Ricky?
I watched it with Sally, but then I didn't watch it with Sally. So, like, I must have watched it. I've attempted to watch it 3 or 4 times this week. And today was like, today I put it on the TV downstairs and both my kids were like, what are you watching, Dad? I'm trying to watch Trapped in Paradise.
They would have loved it.
They watched like some of it and they were like, so we're watching this.
Are you kidding me? Donna Carvey doing the fucking Looney Tunes.
No, it's like, again,
laughter, because, that would be perfect for kids. No?
I was watching it. When I put it on the TV downstairs, I was watching it from the church scene where they go with the whole town to the church.
Oh, right, okay.
So, a lot of the Dana Carvey being whatever he was doing, you know. And it's like, oh, man, I'm going to go to confession. That's what they got from Dana Carvey. It's like, they're Protestant. There is no confessional. But, oh, okay.
You know when Cage turns around to Lovitz, and, well, let's call them by their name. Alvin and what was it? Do you remember the Bill name of the characters in this?
Nicholas Cage, like, just Bill, isn't it?
Furple Brothers. So Furple, we have Bill, Dave, and Alvin, Dave. Right?
Yeah.
They sound like fucking chipmunks.
Yeah.
But,
the other kind of Three Stooges kind of situation.
Oh, yeah. Well, for sure.
100%.
For sure.
Yeah.
But he turns and goes, you just act like you don't know each other. You can see that that's improv. You can see that that's complete improv. So yes, I do believe Lovitz. I think it's the direction is fucking rudderless in this, dude. It's rudderless.
So there are scenes which with Nicolas Cage where he absolutely chews straight through it, and it's amazing. And you just go, "Wow, this could be a great movie." And then then it completely does a 360. And he's like,
look, man, it's the structure of the movie. Ricky was saying he was falling asleep. Fuck, the pacing of this movie, it's its undoing. Because it's every sequence, something needs to happen that it's entertaining. So you're not going to fall asleep. If anything, you're going to groan at it. But it's...
There was a lot of groans.
The entire concept of them trying to... I understand that the movie is called Trapped in Paradise. But there's some shit in this that makes zero sense. There's a moment in which Steve said, and I tried, I actually said to Steve, no. But he was right. Steve, you want to tell them about the fucking car chase?
So there's one instance in the car chase where you've got basically the FBI agents in a car, and you can see that it's veering and they're going to run off the road. The next scene, the same car runs into a tree. There's only one person in
there's
the car.
There's one person in the fucking car.
there's five people in that car, but only one.
Yeah. And this is one of those classic movies that every time there's a stunt, you can see the stunt people swap in. Every time there's a stunt. Even early on when they're running away from the police from the store because the lady comes out and she says, no, the fee for the money. And
she's Spanish,
accent,
okay? She's not Italian.
Whatever. Anyway. And they're running down the alleyway.
Policia!
They're running down the alleyway and
wait a second, stay on that. Because there's a moment in that sequence where, because obviously, is it Alvin, right? Alvin is a kleptomaniac.
Yeah.
But it's the only time in which, I don't know if this was fucking not a guy we're trying to act. Because there's a
sniffing
moment in
money.
Which, no, he's panicked. He's truly panicked. But he's panicked in a way in which, like without dialogue, his reaction, it's more like, I can't control myself. This is a disease. And it's the only time you see it. Mm. And anyway, go on. Sorry.
But when they're running down the alleyway trying to get away from the police, and look, well, I'll say this afterwards, but there's a moment where it clicks and you see, you know.
Is it Agent Dickman? Does it call Agent Dickman?
Okay. Prior to that, when he like grabs them both and jumps into the trash to like.
Like he looks like he's on cables as well.
Yeah, but that's stuntman. And it happens so many times. Every time there's a stunt in this film, click, they swap out to stuntman. And it's so obvious. And I love that stuff. I think that's hilarious. There's so many B-movies that I watch where, you know, it's women fighting and then from a wide angle, it changed to two blokes because they've only got stuntmen.
Wigs on.
Yeah, you know, it's great. I love that stuff. But going back to that, the first 45 minutes of this film has some very decent funny scenes. Even when they're doing the parole interview, everything out of John Lovett's mouth
is actually hilarious.
Yeah. It's really, it's really good.
Lovett's is so fucking funny, dude. That entire monologue.
It's really good.
So fucking good. So good.
But after the 45 minute mark, after the robbery, and, you know, even them like setting up for the robbery when they're trying to find like, you know, the sunglasses and clothes and all that stuff just to like disguise themselves either before or during the robbery or whatever. After the robbery, it feels like somebody said that we're not going to get the right people for this because it's meant to be a Christmas movie. And after the first initial getaway moments, it turns into It's a Wonderful Life or them attempting It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have a point. It kind of the movie loses its identity a little bit. And also it lives from everything. Everything of that period. Like I said this to Steve when we were watching it because he came over. We had a fry up, but then he had stuff to do. So we were on a very limited time slot to watch this movie.
So you couldn't pause while you were watching it.
Well, there was nothing to pause, really. Like there was no deep examination required here. But anyway, there's the entire bit in the restaurant when he's the restaurant manager. And I turned around to Steven and I went, oh, shit, this is the Blues Brothers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, when they're going to, you know, and it's alluded here heavily because it's like, what are you doing here? You shouldn't be here. And that's one. Then it's lifting from Trains, Planes, and Automobiles with driving sequences. There's so much that it's lifting from that it's like 2 years or a few years apart from it. You know what I mean? Mm. Or within the same decade or, you know. There's one thing that I appreciated because this movie came out in 1994. So we are on kind of like almost like a threshold that's being crossed into a world that has the internet, that has phones. And there's no mobile phones in this. It's one of the last remaining movies where, you know, you had to use a fucking phone box.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like it's, And I enjoyed that. And it's used in the movie. Also, you were talking about Lovitz. Man, that entire the punchlines, whenever Lovitz is in the middle of one of those bits, it's phenomenal. Like even during the parole, what do you call it?
Parole boards.
The parole hearing. And he does the entire pterodactyl's speech, whatever. The guy reminds him, he goes, "You're a compulsive liar." There's a pause, and then he goes, "That's a lie." it's just this John Lovitz kind of, he's got that factor that we mentioned before on the show, and that is that he just needs to be. He just needs to be there. You know what I mean? Like he's got that, "I'm an asshole. I know I'm an asshole." And he brings that to every single role. He does it so well. Like it kind of punchable and likable at the same time. It's really weird, man. But there's so many times when he's having an exchange with his brother, with Bill, with Nicolas Cage, and he looks puzzled, as in it's proper improv, and yet it works. I don't know. It's a shame, dude. This movie kind of misses the mark, but I see why it's finding its audience now. And the more we talk about this, the more I'm gonna play like a full reel of Cage going Cage.
Warning: may cause laughter-induced asphyxiation. Thank you, Generation of Swine, who put up that review in 2016.
Well, there you go. There's some good. It is a lot of people's like favorite Christmas movie, which is bizarre. Because again,
really bizarre.
It is
so bizarre,
dude. The entire, which is meant to be comedic, it falls into level of repetition that is unparalleled. Like how they're trying to leave the town.
Oh my God!
It happens so many times that it should technically stop working, and it does stop working. It really does. Like. Also, there's plausibility just fucking, because we suspended disbelief so many fucking times. The viewer is required to suspend disbelief so many times in this. I don't know, maybe that's why you fell asleep, dude. I don't know. Maybe the movie was
like, I remember when I first saw this film. I first saw this film at a pretty young age, probably about 12. Or something, and I have some nostalgia towards it, and it was mainly not Dana Carvey, but the situations I had a big memory of. So the whole mum being like bundled up, kidnapped, and thrown into the back of the car because she's too loud and noisy and keeps singing. I love, you know, as a kid, I love those sort
That's
of scenes.
That's a veteran actor, by the way. Yeah. What's her name? Florence Stanley?
Yes.
Yeah.
But even the whole bank heist, I have a very clear memory of the bank heist, and it was as good as I remember it.
It is funny, yeah.
But as I said, the minute it started turning into It's a Wonderful Life, my brain switched off. And again, veteran actors, Madchen Emick, who I absolutely adore.
She's
from
very pretty.
Twin Peaks.
She's very, very
Twin
pretty.
Peaks. She is one of the best.
She's Fire Walk with Me, isn't she?
Yeah.
No,
she's in Twin Peaks.
Oh, she's in all of it.
Yeah, she's the waitress in the diner.
She's Leon's girlfriend, and I'm feeling really bad because I don't remember her character's name off the top
the
of my
chemistry
head.
Chemistry between her and Nicolas Cage is zero. Oh, it's minus. It's probably akin to the temperature in Ontario when they were shooting
this. But that's why it's kind of believable when she's sort of like, "I don't know why you haven't left yet." Like,
But what about the ending then? That they're holding hands and that's it. Like,
walking away into
what the fuck?
You know,
paradise. With the crane shot as well.
Yeah.
Maybe it's because of, let's have a look at this review. This review says, from Paradise Lost to Paradise Found. Maybe it's that. I don't know.
Jesus
but anyway, the thing is that what I was going to say was that scene in the diner where they're talking about return. Well, Ben, Billy, whatever his name is talking about returning the money.
Yeah.
If you took that in isolation, that's actually a really good
dramatic sequence.
Yeah.
Even when he flips the table.
He flips the table and it says, "Put the table on the tab."
Yeah. I actually like that. I thought that was like a good way of ending that scene.
The shot of the sleigh parked outside the truck stop and them outside. Yeah. That's when, again, you know, first of all, the FBI, the police force, they just cannot stop them. Yeah, okay. Anyway, I'm not going to, like I said it already, and I want you to agree with me. This is, I am still to see a movie where, I mean, okay, this is akin how ineffectual Commissioner Gordon is in knowing that Bruce Wayne is Batman.
Richard Jenkins, it feels very much like he goes in there, guns blazing, and he's like, I don't want local police involvement, I don't want this. And then it gets reduced to that one scene where he's just sat there, I can't remember the hat
with
he's
the
wearing.
Hats.
Yeah, but, yeah, and he's just what?
In the gym, yeah. There's also, during that period, like in that sequence, in those sequences, in the gym, because that's the FBI headquarters now, there's a couple of cops just playing basketball.
Yeah.
And he turns around and he goes, cut it out. What the fuck? Man, the treatment of people with intellectual disabilities in this is fucking disaster. The word retard is thrown around
so much
effortlessly. And that's fine. It was a different time, you see?
It was a different time.
But we are inches away from mongoloid. Like, it's... Yeah. And which is unwarranted, really. But there's one sequence in which, allegedly, all the three people with intellectual disabilities are in the same room, which is at the end. We get Alvin, all right, who's obviously, I mean, he's not meant to be. He's meant to be a kleptomaniac, but he played it like he has some kind of impairment, like an intellectual disability or a learning disability.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Then we have
Paul Lazar, isn't it?
Yeah. Then we have the son of the sheriff, who's the deputy sheriff in the town.
Deputy Timmy.
Yeah. And then we have so much disregard for an entire group that we have the first person portraying someone almost running over another. As soon as they get to town, he almost runs over the deputy sheriff with his car.
On the horse, yeah.
Who falls off the horse. Yeah. Well, then turns out
that's a great scene because they're like, oh God, we've like messed up already. And then when they get out, they're all like, oh, he probably took the horse in front of... Oh, it's probably his fault.
It's probably his fault.
I was like, okay, whatever makes this movie keep going, I guess. Let's just keep going. Oh, but it's...
We get John Ashton's clerk slash...
God damn it, yeah.
Buddy. I don't know. They've got their own buddy cop movie, shitty buddy cop movie going on in this. They're almost not needed. The plot doesn't require this two at all.
No.
They're the newly made deputy sheriffs, right? It's such a waste of John Ashton as an actor because it barely serves the story. Because you think, okay, at some point they're going to take the fall for this because it's even implied that at some point they're going after the money themselves.
Yeah.
It's that's the entire gun. It's got a gun. Gun!
And the bus station. Oh, so terrible. Oh, my God.
There's a moment when they, you know, there's the true heist bit, in which it's the only bit of driving that is actually decent in this, is when they're, which is preceded by the most comical fucking and idiotic. There's a moment in which, because obviously they put, what's his name? Alvin behind the wheel. Out of the three of them, he's the one who's fucking driving. It was completely incompetent because there's a moment in which he starts the car, leaves, then stops, then he creates a pileup, then they're holding money bags and going after him. It's just the entire sequence is so stupid.
Yep.
Yep.
They're basically chasing him. The moment they get into the car, then it looks like a getaway bit, right? And when they get to where they're going to swap cars, there's a moment where there's a Chekhov's gun, which is the key.
Yeah.
They drop the key. There's another moment where I thought, okay, this is half decent, because I thought, why are we shown this now? We have to be shown that they still have the key, okay? And then there's another beat when Edna is in the boot of the car. There's the camera kind of lingers on the number plate for too long. It's almost too long. It's like 5 seconds. And I thought, why the fuck is that important now? And then we're told later why.
It's not really.
Well, well, because the FBI agent kind of recognizes the... Doesn't he recognize the number plate?
Yeah, yeah.
And also, as a viewer, we're meant to know that that red car belongs to... It's...
Yeah.
It's fucking movie, man.
So, thank you, Professor Tom, for writing Roll on the Floor, Laugh My Effing Ass Off. Well done. Yep, good. Yep, that's
Hey, a lot of people like this movie, and I see why, okay? I don't think it's just nostalgia. I think it's finding its audience now. These are very bad times, man. These are very bad times. Oh, some people may feel nostalgic towards this, but... This kind of comedy now, and especially with the mimification of Nicolas Cage, this is up there in possibly the top five Crazy Cage movies.
Actually, you saying that it's found its audience now, there's a review here from 2023 that actually says thoughtful and fun.
Oh my god.
I think every single episode from now on, one of us needs to like find a review page and just like absolutely rip into the reviews more than the film. When we talk about this film, in terms of production, in terms of money, in terms of cast, maybe it was the script that like let it down, because everything else seemed to be in place for this film. You know what I mean? Like,
you know what?
The location was good. The amount of production, like, you know, the snow and all that, even the set pieces within the bank were really good.
No. Except for maybe that one hand section where he goes, oh yeah, you got to use the right key. And it's just like, oh my god.
And there's endless references to the three wise men, obviously, because they're the right opposite. But about Donald Moffat, dude, I wonder how many times on set, because, you know, this apparently the actual shoot of this movie stretched out. It wasn't meant to take that long for obvious reasons, because it's marred by allegedly a director I didn't want to direct. But I'm just picturing Donald Moffat just sitting around just going, I don't want to spend the rest of this fucking winter tied to this fucking picture. Because, hey, you may not remember this, but Donald Moffat was in another Christmas movie or Christmassy movie. He wasn't The Thing, dude.
Yeah,
I don't want to spend the rest of this.
Oh my god.
Yeah. But like
tied to this fucking couch.
But what I remember him from was have I got this right? He is, I'm going to check this now so I don't say
he's Anderson or whatever the bank manager.
Yeah. But
which by the way, dude, some of the stuff that he says that is meant to be really heartwarming. There's a moment when he says, "Oh, you know, like basically the bank is not in a good spot." The commission has found that I
handshakes. Yeah.
It sounds like he's saying something nice, but it is so fucking irresponsible. For like, he's basically saying he lent a lot of money just on handshakes without any credit checks or anything, and it sounds like a heartwarming thing to do for people in the town so that they can fulfill their dreams. But you're tying a lot of people up. To bank loans. It's like investigation because of that, right?
And that connects to why this is like subscribe, hit that bell.
Absolutely.
Connected to it's a Wonderful Life. It's that similar sort of dynamic of a small town. It's that dynamic of everybody's helping each other out until one person messes it up. And in this film, the one person to mess it up isn't the bank manager, but it's these three outsiders. And the whole point of this film is that the three outsiders slowly start realizing that none of these people want them to be outsiders. They want them to invite them into the community to be one of them. In a way, it's like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Shivers,
Rabid.
Oh, there's another thing as well. Dude, there's another thing as well that bugged me to no end. Like, unlike any other movie, there's the entire bit, which, again, really gets... It's forcing you to suspend disbelief. When there's the... They get saved again by another family in the town, whatever the fuck, okay? Not that they're just... That they're already endeared to these people. We need to really bang you over the head with this concept. Whenever stupid Alvin is being rescued, you get a line of people that are... geriatrics, like they're like fucking 75 80, they're pushing 75 80, and they are in cold freezing waters, right? Creating this, you would think that the human chain would actually have two of the links in the water played by the younger, so by Nicolas Cage. There's a pensioner stretch, and then the next sequence Alvin is bone dry. They are all bone dry. Like, not just, I'm not being pedantic here. It's to the point in which I didn't even turn around to Steve. I just went, you know what? Fuck it. There's no distress whatsoever. It's like, can I have a glass of brandy? He goes to the...
But he says, get some warm towels and a brandy. Brandy's for
They're
me.
All dry, dude. Everybody's dry. Everybody's completely dry. Even Alvin. Even Alvin. It makes zero sense.
The only thing to discuss, which happens with Alvin, is that he gets an extra prop, which is for the blanket. That's it.
Yeah.
To say that he was... obviously wet. That's it. That's crazy.
But, I mean, this movie is just... we can keep saying it's of a time. It's of a time. It's of a time. But there's a reason why nobody wants to talk about it from the cast anymore. And actually, there was also other things. Like, the music's really weird about this. It did invoke in me, like, does it remind me more of Home Alone? Does it remind me more of this, that, and the other? But it turns out that the composer for the music is the same composer as a lot of stuff that makes me go, huh, he is of a niche as well. In the Army Now, Ace Ventura, Theodore Rex, The Jungle Book Mowgli story, which is actually the 98 version of The Jungle Book. American Pie Bang Camp, Van Wilder 2. So all of this like random, and then there was one that knocked hit the nail on the head. He did all of the police academies.
Wow.
He also did quite a few of the Don Bluth animations, so Rock-A-Doodle-Doo and A Troll in the Park.
It is a job at the end of the day, man. Yeah, okay, artistry doesn't have to go into it too much.
But what I mean is that they got... Oh, and the big one that was one of my favorites was Loaded Weapon. I love Loaded Weapon. But
it's terrible. I love it.
It's terrible, but it's amazing.
Is that the one with Estevez and Samuel Jackson?
Samuel Jackson.
Yeah. We're going to have to cover... You know what? We're going to have to cover that because I like that as well.
The stupid stuff within it, like somebody jumps out the window, they've already died, but then they like they shift themselves to where the chalk outline is already drawn on the thing. And it's But my point is that there was something really off about the music for this. It was a little bit too whimsical in places, like a little bit like do 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 and stuff like that. And no wonder they got a composer who basically came, just did the job, and probably like took some police academy bits and bobs that didn't work for police academy and just whacked it into this, because it's meant to be that sort of jovial heisty movie. But it isn't, because halfway through the movie, it stops being a jovial heisty movie. It starts to be we're trying to do a Hallmarky Christmas movie out of nowhere.
There's a change of tone that is sudden. Yeah. I'll tell you something else that this movie highlighted for me, because I was going to say it the moment I saw it, and then I thought, fuck it, let's just... Because we had no time. So again, I couldn't stop the movie and have a conversation like I would, which is super annoying to everybody in the room. Your massage appointment, Steve, saved Anne, saved you, from that shit. But the opening sequence, because obviously we are shown Christmas Eve, right? People are shopping. It's New York, hustle and bustle of the big city. And the, I don't know if that was a burp or whatever it was, but I'm not taking it out. It's a sound they made. It just came out from within. And you can see the flow of the extras. There's cars parked, there's gridlocked, and that's the opening shot of the fucking movie.
It's great. And, it's on
Lexington. That's the thing. Because the point I'm trying to make is it made no sense. There's a moment in which you see the flow of extras going through the cars and then circling back. And I thought, oh, shit. I never noticed that this is also the mark of a good director. Because extras are not usually are not veteran actors. And when you have a large bunch of them, to control the scene is difficult. And it's dog shit in this. If you watch it again, it makes zero sense. Because there's a lot of extras and the flow of human traffic doubles back. It's like, this is a fucking studio picture, man. Okay. Like, you know, and if you're not happy with the shot, you're paying this people. Just fucking do it again. It seems like it's a one take thing. Watch it again and you'll see a flow of human bodies going in directions that make zero sense. It's because you can have a person or two in a large crowd double backing or going back to the direction where they came from. But in this, it's like a wave that falls back on itself. It's fucking, and I never noticed this. I thought, okay, the mark of a good director would be, because it's just a position. You're setting a scene. So it's important that it's relevant, because particularly if it's the opening of the movie, because you're setting a level of plausibility to your story. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter if it's sci-fi, horror, whatever genre it is. You're setting a time, a place. You're doing this at the beginning. And the way you do it at the beginning is essential. In this instance, you're demarking a public holiday that is well known all around the world and people are familiar with. Even people that are not Christian or whatever, that don't celebrate Christmas, are familiar with Christmas. That's what you're doing here.
Yeah.
You're setting up Christmas Eve and the frantic pacing of people trying to get to where they're going. You know what I mean? From now on, I'm going to start paying attention to that. If you can control 100 extras and you do it well, then you're a good director.
Thank you for this review from R. Shaw, which is entitled Word of Mouth Will Ultimately Make This a Standard Classic. I think many would like this movie for these three reasons, at least these three reasons. It's hilarious with Cage, Lovitz, and Carvey. How could it not be? It's not just a movie set at Christmas. It really is a Christmas movie. And it evokes another of my favorite films, Groundhog Day. Thank you for that review, R. Shaw, 4969.
Hey, the dog, tripod?
Yeah.
Again, another disabled character in this film.
You got to mention the fact that he was just in the background. Yeah.
Oh, man.
Let's go for it.
This is possibly the Farrelly's brothers' favorite movies, right? It's going to be one of the Farrelly's favorite films, for sure. Because their treatment as well of people with intellectual disabilities was way out of hand.
There was a review that I saw was like, it was like that generation's Dumb and Dumber. I was like, it wasn't.
But no, anyway. There's a movie I can't stand watching.
You know that? Which one? Dumb and Dumber?
Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah.
Working with special needs kids in a school,
right.
You instantly... you just can't.
Yeah, it did not age well. No. It did not age well.
Which is hilarious because I'm kind of the opposite. Even though I work with intellectual disabilities, part of me
kind of goes, welcome to 100 ways for Ricky to get fired. Go on, man.
It's like I still find, is it W. Earl Brown in There's Something About Mary? I still find him hilarious. And I shouldn't. I really
is
shouldn't.
Is it Matt Dillon's character?
No. Mary's brother.
I still find his
character really funny, and I know I shouldn't, and it's great. But at the same time, I also love it when, for example, in the latest series of Twin Peaks, the season 3, that there are some actors that are also used in The Path, which was a great TV series that shouldn't have ended in season 3, where the disability isn't the character. You know what I mean? It's just a character who has that disability. And I love that. Another one is the actress in American Horror Story who is an actress who has Down syndrome, but it doesn't get referred to.
No,
it's basically like she is just a great actress who is fulfilling these horror rooms.
And she's doing a good job doing that. Yeah. You know, I mean, it doesn't take away from a person's ability to act. In fact, it can be an enhancement, and that's one of the good things about this kind of situation.
But I also
have you seen Peanut Butter Falcon?
Yeah. I love that film. Yeah.
It's a great film.
But again, we also, I feel like we shouldn't, there's that whole thing of like, yes, not before the 2000s, all of those movies, there's something really terrible about the way that people with learning difficulties are presented.
Portrayed.
But we also shouldn't be afraid to laugh because most of the time,
100%. Because otherwise, it's pandering, and I'm not doing that.
Yeah,
exactly. I get it.
Not only that, there are certain elements that you should be able to, you know, pratfalls. Everybody finds a pratfall funny, you know, that sort of thing. But yes, if it's directly connected to this person is finding it difficult, and this is why this is happening, of course.
The setting is important as well. It's like, is the joke at the expense of, or is it a two-way street? You know,
that's it.
Like look at Shane Gillis now. Shane Gillis got an entire bit about Down syndrome, but when you frame it, he spent his entire life with people thinking he has it himself because of some of his traits, and he has a member of the family as well that is very close to him. So you know, the entire grilled cheese sandwiches he's making them at night. I don't know if you're familiar with Shane Gillis' routine. But it's now ingrained in the zeitgeist. So people are – I haven't seen many instances of people perpetrating the joke in a negative – under a negative light kind of thing. It's much lighter. It's much lighter. And and the protagonist of that entire bit about the grilled cheese sandwiches, which is, you know, his Down syndrome relative or whatever – is in on the joke, so it's not the butt of the joke, and that's important.
Yeah,
but anyway, guys, we're getting to the end of this. I'm gonna ask you what you thought of this. I'm gonna start with Steve.
Oh my god, it's a tough one because ultimately, I really thought going into this movie, but I'd never seen it before. But then on the watch with you. Yesterday, I suddenly realized I had seen it before, but I have no recollection of where, when, or why it's still in my memory.
Are you saying this fucking comedy is a repressed memory?
It must be.
Brought to you by Bill Cosby.
No roofies were used. Oh my god.
But you just wanted some pudding.
Anyway, okay. Eat it all up. Pudding for breakfast.
Eat it up. Oh my god! No.
Come on, rate it, man.
I'm going to give it a 4, and the only reason I'm going to give it a 4 is because of how Cage this is.
Really?
Full on Cage.
Oh, as in as a merit?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, as a merit. And I really love the fact that you have moments in this movie that stand out. We were talking about the scene in the diner, and that piece of acting is perfect. And it feels like that is something that Cage has done himself rather than with the direction of the director, judging by other bits. But then you have the table flip. And it's just great.
Put the table on there.
Oh, my God. So I think a lot of this movie ended up being improvised. I've never seen... I tried to track down the original script. I couldn't find the original script to kind of work out what should have been kind of pushed out.
Okay.
But, yeah, I'm going to give it 4... four ski masks out of 10.
Okay, that's not bad. Not bad. Ricky?
I feel like there is a lot of areas in this film where they started to set up a joke and it they didn't have any punchline. Like one scene that felt I actually flat. Enjoyed towards the end was something where they go, "Ma, what are you doing here? Celebrating the birth of baby Jesus. What does it look like?" There's something about those one-liners that actually could have really worked in this film. And for some reason, pacing issues or tone issues, it just didn't work. I really actually kind of hope that this would be just an average film, like, hey, I made it to the end and given it a 5. But it's below average. So it will have to be, you know what, let's just say I did want to give it a 4, but just because it's funnier, let's give it 3 tripod out of 10.
Ooh. Oh, you piece of shit. You stole my unit of measure for my scoring. Oh, what is now?
Oh, fuck.
Sorry, I got to that. I didn't even look at you at the time, but I knew that one of you would have used the dog as a measure.
Yeah.
Okay. I think you guys have been pretty harsh. You're going to be shocked now, but because yesterday was kind of almost difficult to get through it, you know, because the moment I was ready to quit, Dan Cage went full cage and I remained engaged in cage. All right. So I'm going to give this a 6. I'm giving this a 6 because I am now entering the camp of people, which means I am entering full-fledged idiocracy. This is my idiocracy. I'm entering my idiocracy phase as well. I just don't care anymore. But I get it. And it's not a nostalgia. However, I have a very similar experience to you guys as well, which is yesterday, before watching it, I don't think I've seen this. And then as we're watching, I'm like, I have seen this. I rented this out for sure. But my perception of the movie has changed because I am entertained by the things that people are valuing about this movie as well. Because it is, again, if you do enjoy Cage going crazy, and here's what I'm going to do. I'm not just going to score this movie. I'm going to recommend it. I'm going to recommend this to people that like to have a house full of Cage memorabilia with pillows and mugs. And if you get off on that, watch this movie. You need to watch this movie because there's so much fucking unchecked Cage in this. You realize how important it is towards your little hobby. Yeah. Or your little fetish. So it's a 6 for me, and it's a 6. It's 6 jawbreakers.
Good. Yeah.
Okay. That's good.
Yeah.
On a sub note, I know I'm going a little bit off. In Australia, the Arrow Film of Australia umbrella, which has a free streaming service called Broly, and I know we're not being sponsored.
That's
by
kind of cute for a streaming service, by the way. It's called Broly.
Yeah.
I don't remember umbrella. I know the company you're talking about.
They have the rights to Caligula.
Oh my
so
God.
What they're doing, and this is now going to be my Christmas viewing.
I'm just wondering what you're... Oh, that's your segue. Okay.
Okay, so this is going to be my Christmas viewing because Broly are releasing this. They're releasing this over the Christmas period.
Caligula or Trapped in Paradise?
Caligula.
Okay.
Right. They are releasing the Italian cut. It's already out. Mm. On the 10th of December, they will then have the Australian rated cut. On the 17th of December, the pre-release cut. On the 24th, Christmas Eve, the uncensored cut. And on the 31st, the ultimate cut. The one that's only just been released this year.
What a blasphemous release schedule.
I am ending this year.
Yeah.
And I will keep you guys up to date. But I am ending this year with Caligula once a week.
Wow.
I mean, I knew you were a McDowell fan, but okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a fetish you could have kept to yourself, mate.
Oh, but I think this is going to be hilarious. This is going to be like my little like snippets that I'm just going to throw in. Be like, so I watched the Italian cut this week.
Okay.
And things like that. Oh, it's going to be.
That's up until Christmas.
It's up until New Year's Eve. So,
oh, which I is thought we're Christmas, recording. In Christmas yeah. Day, you were going to pick with like Salo. Oh. a double bill. Salo.
I'm going to enter 2025 being like, I have seen so much penis.
Holy shit.
Completely uncut penis.
Oh my God.
I'm just going to leave with my section here with
you're gonna leave your section. How much yeah. circumcision are you going to bring into this?
No, we're not
gonna cut
about
this
that.
Out, or we're gonna leave it in.
I'm gonna, I'm sure you would like to.
let's take it back from the tip, boys.
I just wanted to say that John Lovitz has basically turned around and said that everybody in the cast hated creating this movie to a point where they called it Trapped in Bullshit.
Yeah, that's I believe it. I believe
it back
all of it.
To the movie we're talking about.
Yeah. I believe in Lovitz.
You believe in Lovitz.
And I will rise high. Hi.
Like a pterodactyl.
Was it a pterodactyl or a pterodactyl? Pterodactyl.
What are we doing next week, boys?
Oh, I don't know. Let's figure it out. It's got to be a Christmas movie, right? Because it's going to be a Christmas movie.
Yeah. So we do a comedy, or do we do an action? Or we've done a comedy, so it's got to be something.
Yeah,
else.
We did a comedy. Thank you, Umar.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we forgot to mention this was my fucking pick. And on that note, this was Umba.
This is Ricky. Steve.
Ooh, let's do that. Okay. All right, let's try that again. Go, Umba.
And on that note, this was Umba.
And me, Ricky.
Steve.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Merry Christmas.
Bye. The birth of our Lord Jesus.
Christ. Leave the state. You're in my custody. You cannot go. So just quiet down, my little one, and call me Dad.
Who's got a key? Raise your hand. You got a... No? All right, your hand.
Key!
All right, you fashion queen. Who's got the key?
My husband is the only one with
the key.
I just did what the map said. I made four lefts.
Four lefts? As I start going, you idiot!
Are you sure?
Ow!
Oh.
Ow! Ooh! God. That hurt!
It's another long and miserable story that I'd rather not get into. Right now, there's a three-legged dog over there staring at me.
Oh, it's tripod. I mean, the tripod.
What the hell's the matter with you? Sing at the top of your lungs, jumping around like Fred Astaire. I'm getting this feeling that you're not telling me something.
Can we stop and get some ring-dings and milk?
Ring-dings and milk?
Ring-dings and milk.
Oh, yeah. Then we can get some balloons. We can go to the puppet show. What are you, 2 years old?
Life is great, yeah? Huh?
Isn't life great?
And what have we here?
$275,000. Do you mind signing here, Mr. Anderson?
All right, quit pressuring me, please!
I'm just saying, something smells good. Nothing better than that smell in the whole wide world.
He smells good. We got the beginnings of a real situation here. I just robbed these people. I don't want to get to know them, all right?
I know how your mind works. You know exactly what you're doing. And the whole time, you stand there with this who me expression on your face!